Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
And this is Dan Abuhop.
With Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper.
September 17th, 2017.
It turns out today is Friedrich Wilhelm von Steuben's birthday.
Yeah.
He was born on September 17th in 1730. And yesterday in New York, there was a parade.
Wow.
He actually was a hero of the Revolutionary War, the American Revolutionary War.
Right.
He was a Prussian, but come the time that he's a little bit unemployed during the American Revolutionary War, comes over to the U.S. in about 1777, and finds work.
Yeah.
Ends up eventually as Washington's chief of staff. And it turns out he's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
I had no idea. I'm fascinated by him because my father was named after him.
Well, that's
Steuben.
That's the connection.
And so the idea that there's a Steuben Day in New York and a Steuben Day parade has always tickled me. Mm. But this guy was interesting.
Okay.
He did a lot to make the ragtag assemblage of volunteers, apparently, into an army, including figuring out where latrines should be.
Good.
Not to mention, what else did he do? He did, he was actually, he had a lot, he was good at planning training.
Mm-hmm.
And he would figure out the drills, tell them to his secretary in Prussian, who would translate them into French.
Yeah.
And then they had another guy who would translate the French into English. And then convey it to the American soldiers.
Well,
so it was a complicated
situation. I'm sorry we missed the parade. Your dad was really named there?
He was really, and soldiers liked him because he was good at profanity in many languages.
Wow.
I mean, what a man.
Hard guy to find. No question about it.
So there's a parade, and the parade actually celebrates, to some extent, the German heritage in New York, especially.
Right.
And it would go through Yorkville.
Right.
And which used to be lined with all manner of
German
stores,
sure, yeah,
you know, shops,
Bremenhaus,
restaurants,
right,
etc. Mm-hmm. Now we're down to one.
Is that right?
Yeah, apparently the Heidelberg,
oh,
where they serve Wurst and big steins of beer.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's something that's been fading. It was kind of, it was interesting. I used to go there and buy some German type.
No, I used
items
to play basketball down there.
Yeah.
I know the neighborhood. Yeah.
But so we're losing these little niches of.
For sure. That was a big name. All right. So our lead story, I think you're going to tell us a little bit about how to have an ideal vacation.
Well, we have come to the end of vacation time,
right?
Which is too bad. But in the Wall Street Journal, no, in the New York Times, actually, there was an article by a man named Richard Friedman, who's a professor of clinical psychiatry and director of the psychopharmacology clinic at Weill Cornell Medical. And what he says is, you can, to some extent, bring your vacation home with you. But before he even gets to that and how to do that, he notes some studies about vacations. And maybe this is surprising to you, maybe it's not, but it turns out that the longer the vacation is not necessarily important.
No.
And one study in particular shows that 8 days, day 8 is the magic day.
You want 8 days.
You want to try to get to 8 days.
And once you get to 8 days,
it
diminishing marginal returns.
Exactly.
Well, let me just break in on this presentation for 1 second. As it happens, perhaps it's no coincidence, there's an article in the Wall Street Journal today which says that you better get home after 8 days.
And why is that?
It's because your car, when it's parked at the airport after 8 days, is likely going to have a dead battery when you return.
Aha!
And the reason is this. The reason is that all the new electronics put in cars, in particular luxury models,
and they're still eating up the juice,
will continue to eat up battery while you're gone. And they give an example. One reader of the column left his Mercedes-Benz Cabriolet at the airport for 9 days. When it returned, the battery is completely dead. Not even enough juice to activate the door locks. And they called the dealership. They said, well, they weren't particularly surprised. This happens due to electronic activity in the advanced cars.
All right, so 8 days is the magic number.
8 days, you got to get home.
The other thing that's interesting is we're all about, you know, turn off the devices, right. You know, go cold turkey, et cetera, and so
forth. While you're on vacation, right.
Be yeah. away from work. Don't do any work.
But it's not necessary?
Yeah, Mr. Friedman here, probably yeah. Dr. Friedman, I'm guessing, says, actually, some people may find it stressful to sure. turn off to that extent and yeah. will have a better vacation if they can
right.
occasionally take care of little things, check some email, mm-hmm. et cetera. And he tells an interesting story or, you know, a nice story about a guy who goes on a nice vacation. His vacation to Tuscany is planned down to the nanosecond.
Right.
And what happens? He has car trouble
right.
with the rental vehicle. And mayhem ensues. Mm-hmm. Not big mayhem, but, you know, he's got to, you know, it turns out his best memories of the vacation are really from the things he sure. didn't plan, the yeah. accidents,
right.
the meeting a guy.
The serendipity.
Who helped him with the car and oh. invited him home to dinner and so on oh. like that. So to some extent, Friedman is recommending that you, you know, embrace the serendipity in your life, even at home, mm-hmm. to try to bring some of what vacation brings to you. He also says, don't be so obsessed with photographing everything you eat and everything you see.
You remember okay? John Gambling went through that. John Gambling, who we used to listen to on WOR radio, was at one point the type of guy who would talk about how he videotaped every experience with his young children. And then one day he had a pseudo epiphany and he said, that's it. I'm done with the video camera. I'm done with the camera.
You find you're an observer, right. not a participant.
Exactly.
And I've heard that from other people.
And he flipped the other way.
And so, In the end, Friedman says, the way to bring your vacation home is not as a collection of recorded moments, but as a few vivid experiences you allow to take you by surprise.
Oh, listen, I'm...
All right, so let's try to keep this vacation going.
Yes, we'll keep the vacation going. Well, one of the ways to keep the vacation going is to order exotic food, or at least order food that seems exotic. Because it's expressed in, originally at least, in a foreign language.
Well, we're not trying to be exotic sometimes when we're ordering these yeah. foods. You yeah. know, it's just, you know, these are the latest, newest, interesting things.
Well, listen, I was...
that we're adventurous, but this summer...
And
this is an article that was on the front page of the Wall Street Journal.
Well, look,
we're not alone in this difficulty.
So I made the mistake in Block Island. How did I pronounce it?
You say, I'll have the tuna poke, please.
The tuna poke. Well, it turns out that was a mistake.
And the nice waitress very gently said, we call it poke here.
Right, poke. Right.
And, okay. So there is poke. And, you know, I've been through, for years, having been to Italy and tried to learn a little bit of Italian.
Right.
I've understood that you don't, that wonderful little appetizer, the bread with the tomatoes on top,
yeah.
is not... bruschetta.
Bruschetta.
It's pronounced bruschetta. The people in the U.S., you know, especially at Applebee's,
yeah.
Pronounce it bruschetta. So, and there's a very complicated and challenging, and look it up on their phone.
Yeah.
That's going a little bit too far. But even today, we were stymied about how to pronounce
it. Well, you know, we're going to discuss briefly LaCroix. Which is the seltzer that's all the rage now.
Flavored water.
If I can use the word
seltzer. And
you
said to me, how do you pronounce this?
I said it.
He said, you know French, you pronounce it.
Yeah.
And I say it may not be pronounced.
Maybe LaCroix. And it turns out we looked it up and that too is a raging debate. But the answer is,
on the website.
Yes, they say it's LaCroix like enjoy. And all those who are saying LaCroix are making a huge mistake. Well, in any event, that would be a huge mistake because LaCroix is the bubbled water. Which is, you know, the Cassetta, which is taking the world by storm. It is the seltzer of choice. They now have sales in excess of $1 billion. They've gone up over 139% over the past year. They have such exotic flavors as peach pear and watermelon.
So do you have money in this? What's fascinating you about
it? It's just that people say, I must have LaCroix. So the question is, why? Why are people attracted to it? And the article in the journal says, well, it's the essence. It's not artificially flavored. It's not naturally flavored, really. It just has an essence. It has a subtle flavor. All right? And so the question is, well, what is essence? And they went back to the company, asked them to define essence. And the company is very vague about it. They say that, well, essence is feelings. It's sensory effects. It's something mysterious.
Well, that's some real marketing double talk.
Yeah, it's
there.
All marketing double talk. But the people who buy it say they don't
it's
care.
It's delicious.
They don't care. It's doing what they need them to do. I mean, there is a Food and Drug Administration definition of essence, which is so totally unhelpful, I'm not going to read it. It's actually just a clear, concentrated, natural chemical that's been used for decades in products as various coffee and shampoo. But no one knows exactly what it is, but they love it.
I think the company knows.
The company must know, and it's certainly being imitated. Polar's has a similar product out. A couple others have a similar product out. Well, when I was growing up, nobody drank seltzer unless you were like your grandfather. They didn't drink.
But by the time we were in our 20s, we were drinking seltzer, and vintage seltzer came in flavors.
Yeah, well, look.
With a little bit of lime,
is hip. I don't know if you remember that Antipodes play that we hated. You recall they had all these cases of soda in the corner. That was all LaCroix.
Oh, okay.
That means something. That tells you that you were the bunch
product
of individuals.
Product placements.
It's all product placements.
Another reason.
Yeah.
To be product suspicious place. Of that play.
Well, it's just another sign. Another sign that the apocalypse is upon us, perhaps. Well, we'll get to that in a minute. But first, I want to talk a little bit about an article in the Times about The Princess Bride.
Princess Bride. One of your favorite movies.
No. One of the kids' favorite movies. It's okay. I never thought it was a great movie. I thought it was a good movie. Okay. You remember, it's Peter Falk. Mm-hmm. Mr. Columbo is in there. And you have Robin Wright before she went to House of Cards. And, of course, you have Mandy Patinkin. And others. So, and it's a funny movie. It's a takeoff on it. It's what we used to call a fractured fairy tale back in the days of Bullwinkle and his friends. And it's a funny take on a fairy tale, in this case, trying to free the princess bride. But what's interesting is the Times has an article in their book section about a guy named Ethan Nickturn, who's a senior teacher at the Shambhala Center, which is a Buddhist center in Manhattan. And he has written a book called The Dharma of the Princess Bride, what the coolest fairy tale of our time can teach us about Buddhism and relationships. And it sounds a little bit like a stretch. They do talk about, in the article, how popular the movie is. It wasn't a popular time, apparently. It became a cult movie over time. Mm-hmm. They say even Ted Cruz, during his campaign, was making references to The Princess Bride. and this fellow, Nickturn, was saying how important it was to him growing up. But the Times takes the occasion in this article to sort of test the proposition that it really reflects Buddhism. And they go back and forth with him in the way this interview was written. And they say, well, you know, and the Times sort of pokes at that a little bit. They say, really, is there anything about Buddhism here? Or isn't the film filled with un-Buddhist moments? For example, Andre the Giant plays a character that's good-natured but not particularly self-aware and prone to violence. That's not Buddhist. The bad guys show a little aptitude for personal transformation. That's not Buddhist. And the most famous line of the movie, "Hello, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die." That's not Buddhist. It's all about revenge. And after confronting Mr. Nickturn with this, they actually show him the clip of the scene in which this line is said for the last time by Inigo Montoya. And he plunges his sword into the chest of the evil presence in the movie, who in fact does die. At which point, Mr. Nickturn is forced to concede, not very Buddhist, not very Buddhist at all. And you just say to yourself, well, what's the Times doing here? They give this poor guy a hard time. He's really off on this.
They read a whole article about his book.
Yeah, just to bring that down.
Yeah.
So you knew something was wrong. And here's what's wrong. Maybe something got cut off or the person who wrote the article didn't understand. But the movie doesn't end with a scene where the guy gets stabbed and they say that line. And the person who's as aware of this as anybody else is Mandy Patinkin, the actor who plays the hero who utters the line and plunges the sword. And he was recently interviewed and thinking about the movie. He said, you know, when I did the movie, I too was caught up in the famous line, "My name is Inigo Montoya, he killed my father, prepared to die." But in fact, I was recently rewatching it. And I rewatched the end of the movie. And at the end of the movie, the character that I play, Patinkin plays, is considering suicide. And they say, why? He says, well, I have nothing to live for. I've been in the revenge business so long Now that it's over, I do not know what to do with the rest of my life. And as Patinkin says, he loves that line. Because for all of us, the purpose of revenge is completely worthless and pointless. And that's the point of the movie. And that is Buddhism. And
so once again, you find yourself in the position of kind of straightening out the New York Times.
That's right. And so you have a choice. You can read Nick Turin's book about Buddhism in the movie, or better yet, just rent the movie and see it one more time. That's my advice. Okay. Yes, the apocalypse.
Back to signs of the apocalypse.
Yeah.
First of all, one sign
that
you may not have been thinking about talking about was the movie Mother.
No, I wasn't.
Which Dixon, our local
movie expert. Yes, movie expert.
Dixon Cuff went to see with friends yesterday.
Yeah.
And he reports it's awful.
Well,
even Dixon doesn't like it.
Wait a second. Dixon thought it was a horror movie. And the funny thing about it is it can be marketed as a horror movie, or at least convey the impression that it's something like a horror movie, or at least a supernatural movie. The Times gives it a totally vague, incomprehensible positive review in which they describe it as, quote, a hoot. And they say it's the funniest movie this director has ever made. So maybe
there's a way to watch it.
No, I suspect just the opposite. But in fact, Dixon never had a chance. But for more concrete reasons for the apocalypse.
Signs of the apocalypse.
Yes.
Big article in the real estate section, yeah. New York Times, about the new cool thing in luxury apartments. It's not the washer dryer in the apartment. It's an indoor swimming pool in your living room.
Right.
Salt water pool.
Like.
Salt water.
Of course.
Salt water.
What else?
How deluxe is that? Also, it goes on in actually another article to mention some of these apartments are having other perks, like dog yoga classes, bike repair stations. I know you like that if you lived in an apartment.
Well, that's cool. Now I'm in.
Wine cellars, etc.
Right.
So, you know, if you're interested in selling, in spending 7 to 20 million bucks on an apartment, these are the kind of things you can get.
Well, listen, in meeting the challenge that Tams put forward about reasons the apocalypse upon us, I have the article that says that, in fact, Stephon Marbury is making a comeback and trying to get back into the NBA.
Our buddy,
who's so popular
in China.
He is so popular in China.
He's got the shoes. Is it shoes?
Yes, the Starbury shoes. And we were talking about before this at least ostensible radical transformation. Stephon Marbury
from
the most hated, most reviled player in the NBA at the age of 34, went to China, and after actually a few bounces there, ended up being very popular and much revered. And it turns out this is all part
of
the scheme.
So what's he up to now?
He's back trying to get into the NBA. And there's an article in the Times analyzing whether a player 40 years old can make it into the NBA. And the analogs they come up with are two players who were made in their early 40s, or tried at least, Bob Cousy from years ago, and Vince Carter, who's hung around and become sort of an off-the-bench guy at the age of 40 or 41. And the article concludes, no surprise, that in fact... this doesn't make any sense. They contrast Marbury with Cousy because Cousy was a beloved and respected player. Marbury, a polarizing figure, put it kindly. And later on, they talk about Marbury's comeback as far-fetched as they come. So don't hold your breath. I don't think you're going to see Starbury back in the NBA. There was an interesting article in the paper about video that now appears on social media. Turns out that a substantial percentage of that video is silent, meant to be enjoyed without any speaking whatsoever. Maybe background music, but no talking. And as a result, it's very comparable in a lot of ways to the old-time silent movies. Let me give an example, as described in the article. A recent afternoon, the writer saw videos of a guy accidentally hitting himself in the head with a baseball bat, a pizza being made out of French fries, a dog bathing in a jacuzzi, a woodworker crafting a salad bowl, a tourist riding a slide down the Great Wall of China, and a manatee kissing a snorkeler.
All fascinating stuff.
All fascinating
but no
stuff.
No need of dialogue.
Exactly right. And they say, why do we say that this harks back to the golden age of silent movies? And here's why. And they have a quote from a
professor
of cinema. Well, yeah. Here we go. For coincidental reasons as much as knowing reasons, we've seen a rebirth of a very image-forward mode of communication. This is James Leo Cahill, professor of cinema at University of Toronto. A focus on spectacle, shocking images and tricks, the capture of unexpected moments in instantly recognizable scenarios, an interplay between text and image, and a spotlight on baby and animal stars. All this was true of silent movies
in the early 1900s. Early movies were focused on animals and babies?
Exactly
right.
I had
no idea.
Yeah, and now we're seeing it again. So nothing profound to say except just when you're ready to say something's gone, not gone. The age of silent movies is upon us again.
Okay.
All right, you had something about a new kind of ice cream, Indian ice cream.
Well, it's not that, it's more about recipes.
Go ahead.
As you are well aware,
yes,
I make ice cream.
Highly aware.
So, you know, if there's a recipe for ice cream in the New York Times, I'm going to take a look. And this one actually was for so-called instant kulfi, the Indian style of ice cream, which usually involves long cooking of milk, sweetened condensed milk, to get this great sort of what they call almost chewy flavor of ice cream. But this recipe is very doable, and it's done with sweetened condensed milk and cream, and actually canned mango puree. Sounds fabulous. I'm dying to give it a try. It actually has a fair amount of fat in it. In fact, the ice cream I make generally has a good amount of fat. And I say good advisedly, but ice cream tends to be smoother, softer, and, you know, tastier.
More satisfying.
With the fat.
Yeah.
So should we feel bad about that? According to the New York Times this week,
No.
In the health section, they quoted a study. An international team of scientists studied diet and mortality in 135,000 people between the ages of 35 and 70 in 18 countries, okay, studying and following them for an average of 7 years, all right? And it turns out that consuming higher saturated fat, well, you know, they compared the high carbohydrate intake with the fat intake of these people and the mortality rate. It turned out that consuming higher saturated fat, polyunsaturated fat, and monounsaturated fat were all associated with lower mortality. So, you know, ends the article saying guidelines that recommend too low a percentage of fat in your diet may actually be detrimental to your heart health. And I do want to also mention in the Wall Street Journal this week, there's a recipe for sweet potato cinnamon rolls, sticky buns, okay, which looks awful. Not about the sweet potatoes. I think I could craft a great sweet potato sticky bun recipe. This one has you making about 9 rolls with 6 cups of flour in addition to the other ingredients. I mean, that sounds like one heavy bun.
Okay.
So I can't believe.
I know. Your theory has always been they never actually do the recipes. They just write them.
Yeah, I mean, this is from somebody's cookbook, but even cookbooks, the recipes are often not properly vetted.
Right.
So.
Okay. All right. So.
Word to the wise.
Yes. Speaking of complex formulas, Windchill. Here was a revelation that came out because it came out in connection with an obituary of a fellow named Maurice Blue. So here's what Windchill is. Windchill is supposed to give a sense of how cold it is. Based on both temperature and the wind. And the reason that there is some interplay between the two is this, that when air is still, when one's standing outside in relatively chilly weather, the air forms some sense of insulation so that the heat in the body is not necessarily going to all be transferred outside the body into the open air because there's that level of still air inspiration.
So we're surrounded by an aura. Of heat.
Not heat, just an insulation layer.
Insulation.
That's insulation.
Keeps the heat
still
in.
Air, still molecules. But
still, molecules.
Once the molecules are moving, all heck's breaking loose. Because once the molecules are moving, then in fact you don't have that insulation layer. You have, as a result, the heat leaving the body going out into the air because there's now a vacuum. And that's why when there's wind, you feel colder. The heat's leaving
your
body.
So you do feel colder. It's a real thing.
No question. It is a real thing. So the question is, how do you convey to people that, in fact, given the combination of the temperature and the wind, it's going to feel X cold, and that's the wind chill factor. Well, here's the insidious problem here. That they came up with a formula for calculating wind chill that was prevalent when we were growing up. And you would get the temperature, and they say it's 35 degrees, but the wind chill is -2, or it's -10, or it's -15. Great. And you get a sense of that, and you dress accordingly. Well, Mr. Bluestein, in 2001, not that long ago in the age of things, came up with a new formula. He said, that's just off. That test is overstating the effect of wind. And the completely new formula, which was accepted, now results in an entirely different set of numbers. As a result, that you, I'm showing Tamsin a graph which compares what the old wind chill numbers were compared to the new wind chill numbers, the new wind chill numbers being a line substantially above the old wind chill numbers.
Yeah.
As a result, you could have a conversation between someone a little older and a little younger, in which the older person says, gee, you know, when I was a kid, it was freezing cold all the time. The wind chill was around -20. Look at today. It's just gotten warmer. The wind chill's like 0 or +5. And in fact,
it would be true. I don't think anybody remembers what the wind chill factor is.
It would be true, but in fact, they're describing the same conditions.
Yeah, but
the wind chill has changed.
Yeah, I have noticed that it's not as satisfying. You know, they'll be saying there's, 20-mile-an-hour winds.
It's not as low as it used to be.
And,
we used to deal with very low wind chills. We don't deal with that anymore.
Well, I'm going to go with the old way because it seemed more dramatic.
You can't. It's confusing. That's
it felt
sure.
really, really cold.
Maybe that's why there's global warming in people's
people. 10 degrees difference just doesn't do it.
Okay.
So stick with me here. I have kind of a long story, but it's kind of fun.
I'm bracing myself.
All right. So here's the deal. At the beginning of the year, I always give these introductory lectures.
Yeah.
And one of the things I do is demonstrate the connection between ancient art and current art.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my examples is I show a picture of the Enchantress from the Suicide Squad, and she's wearing a kind of headdress that is exactly like a headdress that the goddess Diana wore in many sculptures from ancient Greek and Roman times. And the actress in this case is Cara Delevingne.
Oh,
and so meanwhile, I've also read several articles recently that mention this woman, Doris Delevingne, who was also known as Doris Castleross. And in connection with, she apparently was not only wealthy, but she also was quite the extraordinary
companion.
Okay, and physical companion.
Right, I'm
and she was mentioned in an article in a book about a book in the Wall Street Journal a couple weeks ago. She was mentioned this week in an article in the Wall Street Journal about a book, and both times they quoted, they had the same quote from Winston Churchill, who apparently was experienced her skills. And not only did he experience her skills, his son experienced
her skills. He was hopelessly in love with her, as was his son.
He was not in, well, I don't know. He painted her portrait 3 times.
Yeah, something.
Okay. And the quote from him is, she, meaning Doris, according to Winston, could bring even a corpse to climax. And that quote was in both articles. And this article was about a famous palazzo in Venice that was never finished, but various wealthy women lived there, including Peggy Guggenheim. So today when I open the style section, I read this, but then I open the style section of the New York Times, and there's a picture of, there's an article not about Cara Delevingne, but there's a picture of her there. And it turns out that this famous lady was Delevingne's aunt. Okay, so I knew I had to bring her up. I mean, it was like constantly.
Too much of a connection to overlook.
Either that, we're going to read another article next week about her.
I think you will anyway. Cara Delevingne is pretty well known, but no one's quite exactly sure what she does.
I think you could say that about her aunt as well.
Okay, I'm not going to say
that.
No,
let's move along.
All right, so my own literary contribution here is a little bit of a different take. There's an article about Philip Roth. In the Wall Street Journal, who's written a book called Why Write? By coincidence, John McPhee's written a similar book about writing just this month. But I don't want to get too deeply into these books. Just a couple of things that Roth says here. And I'm interested in Roth because, quite frankly, I do read a lot of Philip Roth. His major point, the major point in the article, and one of the major themes of the book, is that it's about the trivialization of everything. The superabundance of information in society results in the trivialization of everything. And I think there's something to that. That's his major theme. That's a serious theme that I'm sure he explores well in Why Write. But there's one very interesting story in here which demonstrates or illustrative of Mr. Roth's frustration with websites and social media and the like. There is a book that Philip Roth wrote that I happened to read recently called The Human Stain. And the main character in the book, he's called Coleman Silk in the book, is a person who's a professor who is actually black, but he passes for white.
Mm-hmm.
And while he's at the university, after many years, when he's relatively senior, he says something which is interpreted as being racist, even though one could argue that clearly he wasn't racist. But in any event, it causes such a firestorm that it results in him being banned from the university on the theory that he's racist. And so Wikipedia, in writing its somewhat substantial entry about Mr. Roth and his works, writes about the human stain and says in its Wikipedia entry that this book was inspired by the life of the writer Anatole Breuard, who was a book critic for the New York Times. Well, Philip Roth writes to Wikipedia and says to them that, in fact, it was not inspired by Anatole Breuard, but by a professor at Princeton named Melvin Tooman. And Wikipedia writes back and declines to change the entry.
After the author has written in and said...
Here's the quote from Wikipedia. "We understand your point that the author is the greatest authority on their own work, but we require secondary sources." Yeah, so there you go. I think he eventually persuaded them after hammering them quite a bit. He got them to change it. On the subject of great writers, J.P. Dunleavy died this past week. But at least many people regard J.P. Dunleavy as a great writer. I can't say I've really read J.P. Dunleavy. You know, you read 10% or 15% of the book, and it's just tough to pull the trigger on the $7 because it doesn't seem to be going anywhere. But The Ginger Man is described as a bawdily adventurous story of 1940s university life in Dublin. It was banned in many places. It's got a lot of, questionable material, sex, et cetera. And now is now officially recognized as a classic. It sold 45 million copies. And Dunleavy's considered a great writer because what the book is meant to convey of an age clinging to values and which just simply cannot believe and unable to summon the courage to find out what the age's moral convictions actually are. So it's taken quite seriously. He is, it turns out, a tremendously colorful figure. He wrote a book, gives some other titles, none nearly as well known as The Ginger Man. He's got one called The Lady Who Liked Clean Restrooms. He's got one called, The Dog That Fell from 17th Floor. He's got one called Wrong Information is Being Given Out at Princeton, which I understand has nothing to do with Princeton or Wrong Information. The Ginger Man, you might find it as a movie someday, was a play at some point in New York and resulted in a restaurant that was open for many years by Lincoln Center called The Ginger Man. That's why The Ginger Man existed. Even his family life, his wife revealed just a couple of years ago that J.P. Dunleavy's two adult children with her were in fact fathered by other people. Not just other people, but in fact, the first one was fathered by Kieran Guinness of the Guinness beer dynasty, and the second one fathered by Rory, I'll just say a different Guinness from the Guinness beer dynasty, putting new life into the phrase.
Interesting.
That's right. Guinness is actually the beer to have when you're having more than one. And in fact, there's one crazy thing happens to him after another. He has a great quote here. He had a practical opinion of his chosen career. Here's the quote. He said, "One day, while innocently looking in the window of an old established cheese shop in London, the definition of what writing is all about hit me," he told Time magazine. "Writing is turning one's worst moments into money." So, J.P. Dunleavy.
Okay. I think we'll end with a kind of a touching story, a column from the New York Times written by Cammie McGovern about her autistic son. And it starts with this: "How do you write about the happy life you hope for your child to have when you have a hard time picturing it yourself?" And she goes on to say, "For 18 years, I've dreaded the yearly ritual of writing a vision statement." Apparently, as a part of her son's sort of treatment or education, there would be these periodic meetings where they would get together and try to articulate what they hoped would be achieved with him, for him, by him in the coming year, and very often to be disappointed, and just kind of a ritual they would go through. As he made it through school, they were then asking themselves, what will he do next? How can he participate in society? It had various jobs and been in a lot of social situations where it was just a disaster, and she could not imagine her son Ethan being able to really have a fulfilling life, contributing to any kind of employment. In desperation, she says, "We signed Ethan up to work at a farm that employs young adults with disabilities, assuming it would go the way these other jobs and projects he had participated in would be, which would be frustrating. And soon they would get a call from management saying it's not going to work. You'll have to find something else for him. And actually, in this situation, after 6 months, they got a great report. Things were working out. He was even able to use all kinds of machinery. He was working at landscaping, mowing lawns, using blowers and mowers that they couldn't dream that he'd be able to. And they got together for the annual meeting. And Cammie said, "I'm sorry, I didn't really have time to put together a vision statement." And they said, "That's okay. Your son has." And it turned out he had put together a very articulate expectation of what he would like to do, which basically involved...
I'll read it. It's very simple. He said, "After I graduate from high school, I plan to work at Prospect Meadow Farm until I retire and live at home with my family as long as I can. I'd like to keep taking classes at Berkshire Hills Music Academy. For fun, I want to play Special Olympics basketball, go to our cabin in Vermont and the shore in New Jersey, mow lawns, collect business cards. My goals for the future are to take the bus into town and make purchases, and someday learn how to drive a zero-turn lawnmower."
And the beauty of that is it was an entirely reasonable vision, and one that kind of focuses on your future should look like the best parts of your present. Something that we can all put in practice. But the other aspect, I think, that's very true for all children, not just autistic children, and for parents, not just parents of autistic children, is that the growing up and maturing of your children is not a linear process. And when you least expect it, your child will continue to grow and change even over the age of 21.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a nice story.
So there you have it. Once again, from Tamsin Granger.
Dan Abuhal.
And we'll see you next week with Tamsin and Dan.
Read the paper. Thanks a lot.